Housing for the Aged Action Group, HAG for short, a housing group for older people run by older people. Present
Raise the Roof!
We advocate for secure, affordable and appropriate housing. So listen up on the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30pm on 3CR 855 on your AM dial.
That's right, you're listening to Raise the Roof, a show about older people and housing justice from Housing for the Aged Action Group. Today we are doing a special for International Women's Day. If you are not familiar with our program, you can ordinarily listen to it on a Wednesday afternoon at 5:30, the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month. So some of this may be new to you, and hopefully you'll be so inspired by what you're about to hear that you're going to tune into our other shows, our other regular shows. My name is Fiona. I'm one of the co-hosts of the show. Unfortunately, I don't have my other co-hosts, Shane and Pam, here with me today, but that's all right. We'll soldier on. So today we'll be talking a little bit about older women and housing justice, and as hopefully you will be aware, older women are the fastest growing cohort of people experiencing homelessness. And we've been trying to draw attention to this issue for some time. So we think, according to our research, which was released last year, there was 405,000 women aged 45 years and older who are at risk of homelessness in Australia. And although the statistics show that more and more older women are presenting at homelessness services, we think this is just the tip of the iceberg, and that there's a lot of people who are struggling in private rental, having worked most of their lives often, and older women that come to our service, Home at Last, have not experienced homelessness before. They've had very conventional housing histories throughout their life, which means that they don't necessarily recognise that they're at risk, and don't know where to turn for help. So this problem is something that we talk about all the time, but we particularly want to talk about it on International Women's Day. And we don't just want to talk about the issue in terms of raising awareness. We want to talk about what you can do about that issue, so how to take action to make it better for older women in our community. So we're going to hear from a couple of interviews that we've done over the last little while. The first one that we're going to go into straight away is from some of our early members at HAG. Housing for the Aged Action Group's been around since the 80s, and we've had older women running the show ever since. And you're about to hear from two people who were some of the early members and who were housing activists in the 70s and 80s. So we'll go straight into that now. We're joined today by Maureen Donnelly and Joan Doyle from the Mornington Peninsula, just out of Melbourne. How are you both going today?
Hi, Fiona. Hi, Shane. Coming to you from Bunurong, Boonwurrung country here, where the huge swathes of land were stolen by the colonisers and upon which rests our current housing system, where the thievery continues at the hands of banks and developers and agents, aided and abetted, of course, by the state.
We normally have to gas our guests up before we get this sort of content going, so I'm happy to get there right out of the gate. Thank you. And Joan, do you want to say hello?
Yeah, hi, everybody.
So, Joan, I want to start by asking you, you said that you first got involved in sort of housing politics, the field of housing, I think in the 70s, is that right?
That's right. I was involved for a good 10 years, around mid-1975 to 1985. And it was a very interesting time because housing activism sort of changed from, it used to be academic planners and lecturers and people like that, and then a whole lot of younger people got involved, and it was a different era. This was about 50 years ago, so, you know, it was the Whitlam government, and things were on the change. We'd sort of come out of, the Vietnam War and Springbok tour protests and things like that. And so at that time, there seemed to be an upswell of lots of young people, and the need was great, like it's probably even greater today. But there were a lot of people who believed in, you know, that old adage of organising, educate and agitate. And so we did a lot of direct action and, were fairly in their faces, lots of publicity and lots of doing things for ourselves.
I mean, what sort of issues were you organising around? Like, what were the housing issues of the mid to late 70s?
Well, lots of people were homeless, and so I think it was the start of the Squatters Union. I know that the Whitlam government had put a lot of money into regional development, and so there were some resources. Like I started off working for the Western Regional Housing Council, and there were a lot of other regional housing councils. And what we did was organise groups of people to go get their housing rights. So there was a real upswell with people squatting empty public housing, Defence Force, also railway housing. I think we had about 40 squats on the go in the Western region at, one time. And then tenancy law reform, people were agitating about that. Lots of protests about the public housing budget and, of course, women's refuges, youth refuges, things like that were all, people were doing it for themselves sort of thing.
That regional structure, those regional housing councils, was critical because we were able to connect with tenants or people seeking housing at a local level, and we were enabled to work, to enable them to fight for their own housing rights and then connect in through the regional housing councils to shelter. So that really, it really became a movement. And at about the same, so Shelter Victoria, which, played a coordinating role. So it really highlighted the shortage of public housing, that the housing system was stuck. It was private rental or private ownership, infinite queues for public housing. I think it's probably even worse now. But it was such a way to build activism from the ground up.
You were both obviously a lot younger, as we all were in the 70s. Were the issues around the housing around younger people, and you mentioned family violence, and did older people get involved later? What was the genesis of the focus on older people and housing?
So at the time, at least in the Western Port region, where I was the coordinator of the Housing Council, there was already a lot of local housing action, housing support groups throughout the peninsula. We had Mornington Housing Group, Southern Peninsula Housing Group, Frankston Housing Group, Hastings, Pakenham, Chelsea. And then one of the housing officers at Frankston, and Bernie Duff, who was also based at Frankston Council, were working with a small group of older tenants who were also stuck in the housing market. What can you do on a pension? It's just not affordable. Private rental wasn't affordable. And they became the nucleus of the Housing for the Aged Action Group. And we think it was probably around late 1980s, early 1990s.
What was it like to squat back then? Did the police get involved? Was the local councils involved?
All of the above, Fiona. But there was also, like I was saying before, there was also that link with through regional councils to at the statewide level through shelter. And so we would do things like, I've got a fantastic photo of the Housing for the Aged Action Group all bundling into a bus and going off to Canberra at budget time. that we have done demos outside the Ministry of Housing offices.
Remember, we occupied the minister's office one time.
Which minister was that?
Well, it was actually Kenneth.
Tell us about that. How did you go about occupying his office?
Well, things were really different then, and I think nowadays you probably wouldn't get far because the state's much well better organised. But in those days, for example, if you squatted a Defence Force house, you know, we would know that it had been empty for so long because of our local knowledge. I was in the Western area and Maureen was in Western Port. But, you know, you'd go to the media and say, we've put this family who's homeless, you know, have got in here, it's been empty for 4 years and they're willing to pay rent. And the police wouldn't actually hassle you. Once you'd actually taken control of the place and put a note on the door, we used to put, you know, put legal notes on the door of various legal validity. but, you know, once you were occupying, they really wouldn't try and get you out. And we used to have whole streets in Laverton. There were whole streets of empty houses. So there'd be lots of single mums who'd help each other and look out for each other and mind each other's kids and lend each other money and food and stuff. And people were too ashamed. The Defence Force and Vic Rails and public, if they were public houses, Ministry of Housing were too embarrassed to get you out. And it was a bit, you know, because we were young and non-threatening, a lot of women and children, same with the minister's office, that they really didn't want to be seen to be throwing homeless people on the street. And it was a really different time, you know, like it was the Conservatives had been kicked out and it was a time of hope and change and people, you know, people expected something different from the government. And I think, you know, times now are just so completely different. Basically, 1972, it was Whitlam to 1975, and the Whitlam government put a lot of money into the community. So there were a lot of community groups that were funded and regional groups and, you know, they talked, you know, they increased the public housing budget and it was, you know, it was a time of change. And, of course, that didn't last very long. But, you know, there wasn't an immediate backlash against people who were pointing out the errors of the system and, you know, getting publicity and agitating. The state government, I can't remember. I know there were a lot of scandals prior to this about Ministry of Housing land deals and a lot of corruption and stuff. And so I think they were a bit embarrassed too about, you know, coming cracking down too hard on, you know, all these, you know, young people and mums and, you know, pensioners and things like that.
We've heard some stories on the show before about their willingness to kick women out of public housing in those days, but
because we were fairly well organised, like we'd have legal backup, we'd have lots of people, we'd put media releases out, and you know, like we used to be actually very good at breaking and entering. I remember a really funny story where me and this other woman, who I'm pretty fat now, but she was fat too. So both of us were stuck in the toilet changing what you used to do is take the pins out of the doors so that you could get in. And we'd got it through in the louver windows into the toilet and then the toilet door was locked. So we had to take, and the cops were outside patrolling and they were talking, going, oh, those bloody squatters and, you know, giving us the pip. We were having a nice quiet night and, you know, are they there or aren't they there? You know, so basically, you know, we were pretty efficient and then, you know, the family is all ready to move in a moving van and lots of people there to protect them in the beginning until things, you know, they weren't going to be thrown out. And they, lots of brave people, but people didn't have any option. They were living in their cars and couch surfing and living outside, so you know they were up for it and they were really you know, believed in their rights to have a house. You know, housing was a right. Now it's sort of all this welfare crap, you know, and people need all this support and that. Whereas people were saying, no, just give us a house and, you know, we're willing to pay rent and we can't find a house.
And I was actually just going to quickly mention, we were also very creative. Like there was the squat that in Mornington where we actually held high tea and invited, I think Ian Cathy was the Labor minister then. We also at one stage auctioned Bob Hawke's house. And we did street theatres and like, but we were just, you know, then housing activism was driven by, you know, we were, people for public housing said it all. People were just so committed to housing as a right, and not something that should be stigmatised and welfareised and therefore rationed, of course, by the government. But we shouldn't overlook also the role of the women's movement. So in the early, probably about the mid 1970s, there were women's halfway house, squatted Holden Street flats. So the, and the same thing there. There was just this strong conviction by women of their rights, housing as a right. So I think, yeah, that's Jones, that is a fundamental. So hopefully, you know, that conviction of housing as a right is still driving housing these days. And it looks like, Fiona, from the talk that you gave at our Southern Women's Action Network meeting, that that's very much the case. Yeah. And I was thrilled to hear that still the people who are the ones affected, the people who want housing, the people who want to assert their rights are very much involved in the organisation. So it's not one that's become sort of bureaucratised.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because it sounds like the peninsula was a bit of a hotbed of housing activism. And we had Peter Sibley on the show a couple of weeks back who was involved in one of the co-ops down there. Was the co-op movement a radical movement as well in those days? Do you think there's lessons that we could be learning from the concept of a co-op?
And just to say, I don't really think that the peninsula was a particular hotspot. I think it was pretty much statewide. But, yeah, just those housing groups that I mentioned before on the peninsula, probably a good half of them did become housing co-ops eventually, and very much again driven by those members of those housing action groups who were people themselves seeking, you know, better housing.
So unfortunately we are running out of time quite quickly because I could hear stories about selling off Bob Hawke's house all day. But we wanted to finish up with like some pretty broad, a couple of pretty broad questions for the two of you. Basically about how you see the housing situation as having changed over the time that you've been involved or from when you first got involved. So first of all, how have things gotten worse? And then secondly, to hopefully finish on a more positive note, how have things improved or what opportunities do you see now for change? I see Joan giving a big sigh, so I might ask her first. Joan.
I think things have gotten worse because housing's really got off the public agenda. It became bureaucratised and welfareised and, you know, public housing turned into social housing. I think that really our success was, you know, combining direct action and publicity, and that really the politicians couldn't ignore you when you're in their face. Like we'd go up to Canberra in these buses and take over the city, going round the circular traffic jams of Canberra and squatting, you know, some of the empty embassies. And one time we went into Parliament House and put all this chicken feed all over the public hall because, you know, that was what the public housing budget was, just chicken feed. So they couldn't ignore you. Nowadays they sort of have individualised the problem and, you know, it's people's fault that they can't get housing and, you know, I think things have got so bad that now that, you know, they're starting to talk about changing the system. But, you know, we were really in their face about, you know, how tenants pay twice as much for their housing as homeowners. And they couldn't ignore you because, you know, you were doing that agitation and publicity. And there were lots and lots of people involved, you know, whether they're old or young or women and their kids or whatever. So I'm hoping that, you know, when things are bad enough, people do, you know, stand on their two legs and say no more. So I think it's getting to that stage where people are doing that again.
That was a great answer. And Maureen, I mean, same question for you. What's gotten worse and what do you see as a positive or an opportunity?
Yeah, well, I totally agree with Joan, but I think worse would be the public housing waiting lists. Worse would be, I was talking to somebody the other day, a family with three little kids and trying to find something on the rental market. And the real estate agent said, well, I've got 19 interviews in the morning and another 19 in the afternoon, so I won't be able to even put you on the waiting list. The need is far greater. Hopefully the activism will resurface or is there that will lead towards putting greater pressure on the government, because obviously there's an important role in expanding the public housing sector. I think maybe things that have got better might be that, you know, the variety of housing models these days, like social housing models and, you know, co-ops, maybe improvements in terms of tenant control, tenants having a say over their housing, perhaps that's the case. I don't know, because I've been in Singapore for the last 20 years, where I might just finish by saying most people live in public housing and it works. Government-owned housing, of course, you know, people still eye off the wealthier who've got a condo with a swimming pool in the condo, but, you know, in general, public housing works. So I think that's all I would add.
Thank you so much, Joan and Maureen. Direct Action is my youth as well, and I really love to hear these old stories, and it brings joy to my heart. So hopefully the listeners will listen to this and get inspired to stand on their own two feet and take back their right to housing, as you say, Joan. So thanks again for being on the show. We definitely have to get you back and get some more anecdotes about some good old Direct Action. So, we'll be in touch, and we'll definitely be in touch with Bernie Duff too to hear more about the origins of HAG.
You're welcome. See ya.
You're listening to 3CR
Community Radio,
855 AM.
You're listening to a special International Women's Day edition of Raise the Roof, Housing for the Age Action Group's show about older people and housing justice. And you're listening to 3CR, 855 on the AM dial. So we just heard from two of our early members about the housing activism in the 70s and 80s. And now we're going to go into something a little bit more recent. This interview is with a resident of some public housing down in the Port Melbourne area, which is right on the beautiful bay. And the interview is with Margaret Kelly, and I'll let her speak about what's been happening in her housing estate down there and what they're doing about it. So we'll just head into Margaret Kelly's interview now. Okay, so we're joined today in the studio by Margaret Kelly, who is a resident of a Port Melbourne public housing estate. How are you going today, Margaret?
Good, thank you, Fiona.
That's great to hear. Now, we've got you on today to talk a little bit about what's happening down there on your estate. So before we start, would you be able to tell us a little bit about the Barak Boulevard estate?
Okay, well, I've lived here for 22 years. It's a really nicely designed estate. It's two- and three-storey low-rise buildings. And it's been designed so that every unit is a little bit different from the others, so it's a little bit quirky and a bit unusual. It's a very peaceful, pleasant place to live. People tend to stay here, so you get to know people.
And it's right, close to the beach too, isn't it?
It is now. It used to be right close to the retaining wall, but they've built a beach since then, which when I moved here, I actually thought I'd been dropped on the moon because there was a great empty wasteland going from my place to the station pier, and that has since been built on. And it has a suburb of Beacon Cove there, and they've built beaches to go with that. But when I moved here, there was just a retaining wall that went down to Sandridge Beach. But it was very nice. You know, I thought it was the best-kept secret in Melbourne, actually.
It sounds like
But it seems like somebody's let the secret out now.
It's a shame. So you've lived there for 22 years, and my understanding is that there's quite a few people that have kind of lived there, they've grown their kids up there, been there for quite a long time. Is that right?
Yes. It's always been a pretty stable community. So there is a whole range of people living here, including older people who have raised families here.
Yeah.
Which is my case. But we also have young families with children and couples and, you know, the whole range of people.
Yeah.
And it's been very nice because I've seen, you know, children go from babies to teenagers and, that's pleasant.
And so you all kind of know each other's neighbours and you look out for each other and that kind of estate.
Yes, it really is. And, you know, there is an amazing diversity of people living here, but nevertheless it's really peaceful, you know. Like people just kind of get on and,
And so the government is planning on redeveloping this estate as part of their public housing renewal program. Would you be able to tell us a little bit about what you know of this and how you found out about it? Just tell us a little bit about what you've heard.
Okay. I found out about it on the 13th of December. I came home from my rehabilitation program at the gym, and so I was already feeling a bit exhausted and lightheaded, and I opened this letter, and the first words that made sense is that you are to be relocated, and the picture that jumped into my mind was a friend of mine who would relocate nuisance possums to what he described as a better place. I haven't actually heard it applied to people before. So that was a very great shock because there had been no discussion of it. I found in the next few days that nobody local knew, not our council, not even our local housing office knew.
Wow.
So obviously they had been planning it for a while because they kind of descended on the estate with this orchestrated manoeuvre going round and banging on doors. But obviously they had not wanted to tell anybody up to that point for what reason, I don't know. So, and it was very bad timing because it was 12 days before Christmas. I think most people would think that was not a good thing to do 12 days before Christmas. But particularly for public housing tenants, it means that the organisations that you get support and advice for close down over Christmas.
Yeah.
So it was an extremely, by the time I had worked out who I needed to speak to, they were closing down, you know, so it was a very stressful time. And I found that sort of in the dark, really, for information, that, you know, it just became, I became more and more stressed.
I bet.
Over that time.
And was there much information about what they're actually planning on doing apart from relocating the tenants?
No, they're going to build things that are modern and sustainable and accessible and, oh, all sorts of other nice words. But apparently they don't actually have any plans at all. You know, there's not been anybody appointed to do designs or anything. The first manoeuvre is to move the tenants out.
Wow.
We got a 5-page document, and the only definite statement was that we were to be relocated.
And have they given any sort of indication about where you'll be relocated to?
I can't imagine. I mean, they don't have a whole lot of spare public housing lying around as far as I know.
No.
And, well, my understanding is that they will be putting people in a variety of housing, including private rentals, that they will be subsidising. And I know in the case of one of the North Melbourne developments, they moved the tenants out in 2018 and they are still in temporary housing.
And you've done some calculations, back of the envelope sort of calculations about what did you discover when you put those sums together?
Well, according to quotes that I believe were from Homes Victoria, they were going to spend $16,800 a day on, you know, subsidising rentals. So we're now 4 years down the track. There is still not any housing on that site. So they will have paid out around $25 million putting people into temporary housing, which doesn't seem like a good way of spending the taxpayers' money to me.
No, $25 million. And that's just for the, is that just for the North Melbourne estate, or is that what you...
Yes.
Yeah, right, okay.
That is just for, I think it's going to be called Molesworth. Oh, I don't know. There's a precinct there where I think they removed some older style housing.
Yeah.
And there's been all sorts of problems with the development. And apparently I've spoken to a tenant there, and apparently the plans for the site have changed radically. The amount of housing has been reduced. So they were pretty unhappy with what had happened.
And this development down where you are, I'm assuming they're going to allow you to come back once it's built. Is that what they're saying, or you're not?
Well, yes, they do say that we will have first choice of the available housing.
Yeah.
But then, once again, because we don't have any actual information from Homes Victoria about what they're going to build, but certainly on the other side, the development have been private with a small component of community housing.
Yeah.
And those have been 1- and 2-bedroomed units. So we have some large families on this estate. Well, by today's standards anyway, you know, families with 3 or 4 children. So I can't imagine that they will be able to come back here. And certainly, you know, at the moment I have a unit which has a garden that I'm very fond of, and I can't imagine what they're going to build will be in any way equivalent.
And you'll lose your garden potentially too.
Oh, I'm sure I'll lose my garden. I don't have any doubt about that at all. And, you know, I am mostly housebound these days, so my garden and the little walks I can take by the sea and, you know, my neighbours, that's about the extent of my world. So, you know, unless we're going to kind of relocate the whole community in one place somewhere else, I don't think that's going to happen. So, yeah, I'm not really comfortable because there seems to be a lot of adjectives, you know, but very few facts about what's going to happen.
Yeah, and presumably it'll be a mixture of private and community housing, as they've said, in the other estate redevelopments as well, which means, yeah, so it'll be a different type of community too when you come back to it.
Yes. It won't, there'll be no public housing here at all. And that seems to be on all the redevelopments they're doing. They're replacing public housing with community housing, which, you know, is a good option alongside public housing, but it's more expensive and less secure. And whilst they say at this point that they will continue to subsidise rent, so we'll always be public housing tenants, I have had previous experience of them changing their minds about such things a few years down the road, so, you know, I'm not super confident. That would continue into the future.
And what's been the reaction of the tenants down there and your neighbours?
A huge range of reactions, obviously. Like, I think there's probably 250 people living here. There are some people that need to relocate because they need to be in a place without stairs or they want to be near family. And so this could actually be an opportunity for them to do that.
Yeah.
But for most people, it has been just a huge shock. Like, I've actually been really touched how fond people are of this place and how fond people are of their units. And it's a bit of a mystery to me that Ben Rimmer from Homes Victoria was interviewed on the radio and said that they were not fit for purpose and not meeting the needs of the current tenants. I don't know who those tenants are. Most people seem pretty happy to be living here.
Yeah.
And pretty upset at the idea of these places being demolished. One person said if it wasn't so much that she had to move, it was the thought of this not being here for the next family that needs it.
Mm. And I guess accessibility issues can be fixed in different ways too without necessarily kind of knocking it over.
Yes, that's, I mean, certainly, well, I think there have been people trying to get assistance with making their places more accessible, and it's just basically been refused. So, you know, things as simple as having the bathroom on the same level as the kitchen. So, you know, there are some issues, but I believe that they could be fixed with very simple and not very expensive renovation. Demolish it just seems ridiculous.
A bit excessive,
yes,
to say the least.
Right. Yeah. I keep on thinking of the Vietnam War thing of, you know, destroying the village to save it.
Yeah. It must feel a little bit like that. And you would have seen a lot of change in Port Melbourne over the last 22 years. It's, you know, used to be a lot more, I guess, of a working class suburb, and it's become more gentrified over the years. Do you think this is part of the push to gentrify the suburb? Like, what's your, in terms of just big picture, what impact do you think it's going to have on the broader community?
Well, this is the last affordable housing in this particular part of Port Melbourne.
Mm.
We are across the road from the Garden City Estate, which was the first public housing that was built in Victoria. And this estate was actually built as an extension of that.
Yeah, right.
And when I came to live here, once I'd got over thinking I was on the moon, because it was a bit of a shock, it wasn't actually my first choice of where I wanted to live, I was just, it was such a nice community. It is the only place I have lived in Melbourne where people help you carry your shopping home from the bus,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Just that sort of feeling of other people being there for you. And it has changed very rapidly because of once Beacon Cove was built, suddenly people began to look at this, I guess, as a desirable area. I found the speed of change just astonishing because when I first moved here, a couple of people quite seriously said to me, oh, you can't go and live there. You know, such a dangerous place.
Yeah.
Which fortunately it wasn't. But now people say, oh, you live in such a nice area.
Yeah.
And I think, well, the same area it always was. I don't know why it was considered not a good area before and now it is. But, you know, I just think most of Garden City, most of that housing, because it was sold to tenants, is yeah. now in private hands. So this is really the last bit of affordable housing around here. And I know particularly one family where we've got three generations living on the estate. And, well, it just seems a very sad thing to lose. But as I said, well, I have no idea what they're wishing to build here, but it certainly won't be the community that's here now.
And it sounds to me like this is an example of what public housing is meant to be. It's well designed. It's the close-knit community. People are looking out for each other and accessible to public transport. And it's got nice walks around with the coast right there. It seems a real shame to lose that kind of public asset for lower income people in exchange yes. for who knows what.
Yes. Who knows what exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really not making a sense at all. And, you know, there has been no community consultation. My understanding is that the state government has changed the rules, so there are no avenues for community consultation. The local council has no say in what gets built here, which, well, I just think that's odd.
So we hear that the tenants are starting to kind of mobilise around this issue. I'm not sure if you're involved in any of that, but we'd be interested in having a chat to people who might be trying to sort of, I don't know, I guess stop or change this redevelopment. Have you heard yes. anything about the tenant organising on the estate, or is it still in its too early days?
Well, it is happening. We did have quite a large tenants meeting. As you can imagine, organising things and communicating with everybody on the estate is quite a big job.
Mm.
And one of the things I discovered early on is that there is no local, you know, we used to have a local tenant support service.
Yeah.
But apparently they've all been defunded. So, you know, we are starting from scratch. We had a meeting with, well, a lot of tenants. I don't know how many attended. And from that, there was a committee formed because I have health issues. I can really only be peripherally involved.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we're all doing everything we can. I've written quite a few letters to people that all get sent to the Minister of Housing.
Yeah.
And they get passed on to this relocation team that we have off the estate, which is kind of missing the point, really.
Yeah.
Like, I just really... We have heard nothing sensible, you know. All we get is this not fit for purpose. And, yeah, obviously at this point I don't want to talk to the relocation team when I'm asking why and how come. And
Yeah, it's like it's a done deal and the relocation team are the only ones that are kind of, you know, that they can direct people to, but actually you want an answer as to why it's happening at all.
Yes, so I have written in, to the department, to Homes Victoria, about the situation and particularly about the way it has been carried out and the extraordinary level of stress that it's put on individual people.
Mm.
And asking them to roll back the process so we can actually have a conversation about this.
Yeah.
And, well, they just haven't responded. That was more than several weeks ago. So.
And in the meantime, the social housing regulation review is open, and one of the things that they're asking for public comment on is the idea of putting tenants in the centre. And yet this seems to be happening kind of a little bit behind the scenes. It's a bit either ironic or cynical, I'm not quite sure. But it does seem to be a contradiction that one arm of department is asking for public consultation to the independent panel reviewing the regulations, and then the others are relocating tenants seemingly against their will. So, yeah.
The others are relocating tenants with a bulldozer.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, the immediately after Christmas, I understand that they were back at work trying to get people to sign transfer papers.
Mm.
And one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about is that, they don't seem to really be targeting their communications to the audience. So we get things with QV codes on them.
Yeah.
That you have to have a smartphone to actually understand what it's about at all. You'd think they could at least put a website address on it or something vaguely understandable.
Yeah.
And all the communication is in English, and, well, I don't know the numbers, but I'd say probably a third of the estate speak English as an additional language, and that's been particularly stressful for older people on the estate.
Yeah.
I found that aspect quite shocking, you know. The original communication had a statement on it that was, if you need an interpreter, call this number.
Yeah.
That was in English. There were no other languages. And if you called that number, it was actually the housing call centre where you call for maintenance. I've never heard of them providing interpreters.
Wow.
I'm finding that aspect. It took me a while to get around to thinking about this, but I found that aspect pretty shocking.
It sounds like it's been quite badly done, I have to say. We're really interested in keeping across this issue and talking to you and to the others on the estate more as things go on. Unfortunately, we're out of time now, but is there anything final that you want our listeners to know or to think about before we go?
Mostly just to emphasise again that this is not housing that needs pulling down.
Yeah.
That may have been in some of the other redevelopments, but, you know, this is solid, comfortable, functional housing and beautiful, you know. It's a nice place to live. So I think I would like them to think about it again.
Well, thanks so much, Margaret. It's been really insightful, and as I said, we'll keep across that. And there's always the Save Public Housing website for listeners that may want to jump on and have a look at what's happening around our different public housing estates. But yeah, thanks so much for your time, and all the best with the campaign, and we'll be in touch.
Okay, thank you, Fiona. Thanks for speaking to me.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Brothers and sisters, what a show of strength we've got here today.
Local issues.
So I'm here at the School Kids Strike for Climate Action.
Live coverage.
Join the spirit of this gathering here today at IMAR.
Your voices.
So give us a bit of a lowdown about what's happening.
There's about 250 people here at the moment.
Community struggles.
We're now in front of the Tundaminawaya Morboihina Monument. I'd like to thank Community Radio 3CR, who for the last decade has been broadcasting here.
Feed Radical Radio, your membership is vital.
A few hundred people about to pass us right now. Lots of young people standing up for their future.
Subscribe today.
Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 9419 8377.
You're listening to Raise the Roof, an International Women's Day special on older women and housing justice. We just heard from Margaret Kelly before the break there, and she is a resident of public housing, which is obviously one of the things that we think the government needs to be investing more in to be preventing the crisis that's facing older women and homelessness in this country. And I mentioned at the outset that we didn't just want to talk about the problem, we also wanted to talk about the solution. So the last person that we're going to hear from today is a lived experience advocate from Brisbane, whose name is Linda Hahn. She's part of the Housing Older Women's Movement up in Queensland. And she's going to tell us a little bit about her story and how she ended up finding herself in a housing crisis in later life. She also has a call to action. And this was part of a panel discussion that we had with some federal politicians around housing justice late last year. And we really would like to see urgent policy reform by the federal government. And this upcoming election is an opportunity to call for better services for housing in retirement and social services, income support, to meaningfully address the housing crisis. So we'll hear from Linda, and then we'll finish up with how you can get involved to help change this system that older women find themselves at the pointy end later in life.
As you listen, please remember I am just one of over 400,000 older women in Australia who face the daily challenges and ongoing trauma that arise through not having a safe, secure, and affordable home. This forum is geared to move us from awareness to action. These women need solutions now, and that is why we formed the Housing Older Women Movement. My story. I started buying my first house at age 19 and have owned homes in the UK and Australia, so I never imagined I would experience homelessness. Only when I discovered I was not the only one that this had happened to did I stop feeling ashamed of my situation. I've come to realise that my experience is not my fault, nor due to poor choices, but rather the inevitable result of systemic, economic and societal factors which increase women's vulnerability to homelessness. Older women are generally the invisible homeless, who quietly struggle to get through each day, not yet often visibly homeless on the streets, but only a step away from that. It could happen to any woman you know, your mother or grandmother, your sister, aunt, co-worker, your friend or neighbour. I have predominantly worked in community-based organisations where pay is lower than in other sectors. Some positions have been part-time, and I've taken career breaks to raise my family, care for my elderly relatives, and I now provide childcare for my granddaughter. Historically, society has relied predominantly on women to undertake these unpaid carer roles, which in turn impact on our capacity to build a secure economic platform for our later life. Nonetheless, I thought I was on track for a comfortable retirement until, at age 53, the persistent and unresolved stresses of my job managing a disability advocacy service stopped me in my tracks, and I was signed off work by my GP. I was literally burnt out. I had nothing left and was overwhelmed with fatigue, swiftly followed by depression, anxiety, and panic attacks. The deterioration in my mental health impacted on my relationship, and two difficult years later, I packed my car and returned to my support network in Brisbane. And that is when my homeless journey began. I survived 3 years of temporary insecure housing, making 18 moves in those 3 years. I moved between living with friends and with my son and daughter-in-law, spells of house sitting, staying in B&Bs and caravan parks, and informal rentals found on Gumtree. It felt like an unending cycle of unnerving dislocation, and it exacted an even bigger toll on my life, because you never feel settled or peaceful when you've no security about where you're staying. You can't plan. You can't focus, and you can't get your life back on track. My life had literally fallen apart. I'd lost my health, my job, my marriage, and my home. I recalled images of Humpty Dumpty in the nursery rhyme, in pieces on the ground. That was how I felt, shattered and in pieces, and I couldn't imagine how I was ever going to put myself back together again. Those were some of my darkest days, when I felt constantly exhausted and experienced feelings of desperation, literally not wanting to wake up in the morning. So what you see today, 11 years later, is a version of Humpty, just about together again, but there are still cracks, and it doesn't take much for them to reopen. A word about how I've managed financially. When I returned to Brisbane, I have just $30,000 in superannuation and some savings, but no income, and I was nowhere near well enough to work. 2 years later, my share of the property settlement was not enough for me to buy, so I added it to my super and set up an income stream, which has sustained me, but I'm spending it down quickly in paying private rental that's more than 30% of my income. For health reasons, I haven't been able to meet mutual obligation requirements, but I've recently been assessed to go on the disability employment scheme, so I now receive JobSeeker. Aussies have many wonderful phrases, one of which is, she'll be right. But no, she'll not be right unless things change. Awareness has to be followed by action. Addressing the housing crisis is simply the right thing to do. No older woman should face homelessness in Australia. Let's act together to ensure that older women in Australia will be right. Thank you.
Hi, we're the Marindas, and you're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855 AM.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately, today. So I hope you've enjoyed listening to some older women talking about housing justice and what you can do about it. If you want to get involved in the fight for improving the situation for older women, you can contact Housing for the Aged Action Group. Our website is oldertenants.org.au, and we have some great resources on there about how you can get involved in being politically active around this issue. And hopefully we'll see some change for the better. So happy International Women's Day, everyone, and all the best. And don't forget to listen into our regular Raise the Roof show, which is the second and fourth Wednesday of the month at 5:30 on 3CR 855 on the AM dial. And of course you can podcast that at 3cr.org.au. My name's Fiona, and you've been listening to Raise the Roof, and see you soon. Bye.